This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to talk about, well, it's a little bit of a different issue than we sometimes focus on. Often we focus on diet, lifestyle, exercise, nutritional supplements, various medical breakthroughs. But today we're going to talk about the very state of medicine itself, because that is ultimately crucial to you, our listeners, our Intelligent Medicine followers, who are medical consumers, and you may be at the short end of the stick when it comes to service delivery in medicine these days. You may have already noticed it. There are big changes in medicine. Medicine is becoming depersonalized, medicine becoming automated. And today we're going to talk to a doctor who has something to say about this trend. He's Dr. Gerard Giannoli. He is a medical doctor who is a specialist in something called neuro-otology and skull base surgery. Wow, that sounds very, very high tech. And I guess that has to do with, you know, the nerves in the ear and surgery related to hearing and balance. He is also a clinical associate professor in the departments of otolaryngology, that's ear, nose, and throat, and pediatrics at Tulane University School of Medicine. He has pioneered treatments for superior semicircular canal dehiscence. I'm not even quite sure what that is, but it sounds like a balance disorder and other vestibular problems. He has a worldwide practice. Patients come from all of the United States and from around the world to see him, but we're not so much going to talk about ENT today. We're going to talk about the very state of medicine. And Dr. Giannoli came to my attention because he wrote a very interesting editorial recently entitled, this is a tantalizing title, Electronic Medical Records, The Potemkin Village of Healthcare. So without further ado, here's Dr. Giannoli. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. It's great to be here.
Okay, well, first of all, help us with this analogy, the Potemkin Village of Healthcare. What's up with that?
Okay, well, as a lot of people know, the Potemkin Village analogy goes back to, you know, the late 1700s in Crimea, where Grigory Potemkin put together a village to impress Catherine II to get the area look much more prosperous than it was. And so it's kind of been used as a term to dress up a really bad condition. And right now, healthcare, the visits that patients are getting with their doctors are not the same quality as they have been in the past, and the electronic medical record makes it look like it's so much more detailed and involved than it really is. And in the editorial, I talk about how I saw my pediatrician for the last time, and he showed me my medical record, which was 4 pages long for 20-some-odd years of visits. And today, the average electronic medical record note is like 5 or 6 pages long. Mm-hmm. And it's probably not near as extensive as what my pediatrician gave me back in the day, if you would.
But for the sake of argument, you know, a lot of people extol the benefits of electronic medical records, because clearly, and you and I both know this, we have a problem because we see patients sometimes, they come to our office and we say, well, you've been to 4 or 5 different doctors and you've had all these tests. Where are the tests? And the patient says, well, I don't know. They're here, there, you know, hither, thither, and yon. And wouldn't it be nice if it was all in the cloud somewhere that where you could just click and efficiently download a patient's records and you could eliminate inefficiencies? You might have to not do another CBC or chem panel on a patient who's already had three or four in the past year.
Absolutely. There are certainly advantages to electronic medical record. Now, I don't want people to think I'm a Luddite. My partner had the second electronic medical record system in the state of Louisiana, which dates back to the early 1990s. So we were way ahead of the whole electronic medical record movement. We had it long before any of our peers did. But the big problem is not electronic medical record as much as the way CMS, Medicare, has mandated how it has to be used, how it has to be structured, and has geared the entire payment system around how medical records are used. Consequently, physicians have had to put up with all kinds of cost, bureaucratic burdens associated with EMRs, and also EMRs that are not friendly with regards to recording data and also extracting the data once you get it. To give you an idea, I do a lot of medical record reviews for expert witness work, and I was given the records for a patient who had been to a system with one of these type of EMR systems, and there must have been several hundred pages of records that were printed out for me, but the meat of it could have been put on like four or five pages, and I had to go through all those hundreds of pages to get that little bit of information.
So in effect, they call this boilerplate, because for a while I used to have, full disclosure, prior to med school, I had a job as a paralegal. Okay, interestingly enough. And what we used to do is we used to have to cut and paste or buy forms with, you know, this routine legal language, you know, recitation of a will or recitation of a divorce or real estate deal. And now, just with a click of a button, you can download this, what it's called, boilerplate. It's a standard language that fills in the gap and prevents you from getting writer's cramp. But you're saying that when it comes to medicine, all that boilerplate just adds up to the fog of war.
Yeah, the best way to think of it is there's a lot more noise and a lot less signal.
Okay.
It's all the extra information that you're getting there that is not useful is hiding the useful information. One of the classic things is in the hospital. I could go into the hospital and see a patient, and I can press literally one button, and it will give me a huge, like, five-page note that goes into the hospital record. And the purpose of that is so the hospital can bill for that visit. But from a practical standpoint, it contains so much redundant information that's already in the record to begin with that I shouldn't have to put there except the fact that Medicare requirements and insurance requirements are such that they need to do that to get paid.
Another way of saying that is it makes it seem like you did something, right?
It's exactly.
Kind of automatically,
exactly.
Right? It fulfills the requirement
the
of a visit, right? That you document this and that and the other thing that you may not have even paid that much attention to. You may have breezed through it, and you click on the button, and you know, just kind of gives you an array of, you know, patient denies this, patient shows this, the physical exam shows that, and it's all a menu based operation.
Yeah, to give you an idea, there was a patient in the hospital not too long ago who had four different doctors seeing this patient in the hospital, and each doctor's note was about five pages long, so you're talking about 20 pages of notes every day, and almost all of each of the doctor's notes was exactly the same,
identical,
except for a couple of sentences.
Wow.
In the old days, all you'd get is those few sentences,
yeah,
and you could easily look at and see what was new.
Exactly.
This new way, you got to spend a couple of hours trying to figure out what happened.
Right. So, also, you know, there's issues with the accuracy of these records, because I've seen some horrendous examples where you know, they document a pelvic exam on a male, or they talk about they talk about the testes on a female, just merely because they hit the wrong button. You know, and this is,
exactly,
you know, if you were handwriting it, you know, you wouldn't make these kind of ridiculous mistakes.
Absolutely. And the example I put in my editorial was, I you know, a lot of what I do is vertigo work. And I had a patient who had intractable vertigo who needed surgery, and I sent her to her primary care physician for a pre-op evaluation. And the note I get back from the primary care doctor is that the patient denied any history of vertigo, which, of course, is just ridiculous. That's the whole reason the patient was having her surgery, and it was just, again, one of these, they accidentally hit the button that said no for all the
right.
different questions.
Which is a recital. I mean, for our listening audience, there's sort of a recital that doctors go, patient denies this, patient denies chest pain, patient denies whatever, history of high blood pressure, patient denies nausea, vomiting, blah, 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 blah. And if you hit the, if you don't pay attention, you get a long recitation, and that fulfills the requirements of a thorough physical exam and history. But, yeah, you kind of missed the boat there with that vertigo thing.
Well, and you know, of course, probably the most famous electronic medical record screw-up was the Ebola case in Dallas.
Oh, okay.
Where, you know, the patient who came from Africa shows up to the emergency room and tells the initial nurse that he spoke with that, look, I'm, you know, from Africa, I've been around Ebola, and I have symptoms, I think I might have it, you know, mm-hmm. and the nurse dutifully puts it in the electronic medical record. He then gets transmitted back to see the doctor, where he doesn't mention any of this to the doctor, thinking that, of course, the doctor knows because it's in the electronic medical record. But if you're a doctor, you know, just because something's in the medical record doesn't mean you'll know it, because it's often, there's so much stuff that it's hidden.
Right.
And consequently, this doctor didn't know, treated the guy for the flu, sent him back out to potentially infect other people in the city.
Right. So, and the other thing, and you know, I can attest to this, is that there's a tremendous expense associated with these systems, not just in terms of purchasing the systems. They cost many, many thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy for a private physician. And, you know, it's fine for a hospital, possibly, you know, could invest millions of dollars in a very sophisticated system. But, in effect, these systems are driving small private physicians out of business, because, you know, the economy of scale is such that they got to, you know, work for a hospital or group together in large groups.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. As a matter of fact, there's a Physicians Foundation study that came out last year that basically shows from 2008 to 2014, there's been a mass exodus of physicians out of private practice into employment. And it's directly related to EMR and meaningful use. Roughly in 2008, two-thirds of physicians were in private practice. As of 2014, it was about a third. So roughly half of the doctors in private practice have left private practice, and this is a huge reason why.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that in a little while, because, you know, there are broader implications for the practice of medicine. But recently, the state of New York has taken the step of mandating electronic medical record prescribing so that no more paper prescriptions. And, okay, that means less worrying about locking up the prescription pad and having an errant employee you know, grab a few pages and prescribe themselves some oxycodone. I get it. But on the other hand, it's very complicated to initiate these systems.
Oh, absolutely. And then the other issue is when everything is on the cloud or electronic, as you mentioned earlier, you have other concerns with regards to privacy.
Yes.
And also with regards to computer bandits, if you would. There's mm-hmm. there's been two very famous cases lately where rogue people have gone in and locked up electronic medical record systems
right.
They literally
shut down the operations of a hospital. And, you know, it's so interesting that the hospitals are so vulnerable in that respect. It would have taken, you know, a phalanx of armed men to shut down a hospital in 1990, but it just took one errant hacker in whatever, Romania, to hold a whole hospital system for ransom recently happened.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that we're going to see more of, not less of, in the future.
Yeah. So clearly there's some perils. What about the issue of, you know, having your data snatched? Because, You know, there are cases where literally insurance company employees sometimes leave laptops in their cars. The laptop is stolen. There's all that private information, social security numbers, medical status. And then they sometimes use that information to bilk the insurance companies with phony patients and phony billings and literally destroy your credit.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things you have to be concerned about. And when someone gets a hold of your electronic medical record, they have not just your medical history, but also your social security number, your address, and a lot of other valuable identifying information that they can use at their whim.
Okay. So, you know, what's the answer? Is the answer for doctors en masse to reject this paradigm, to drop out? Do we simply need to initiate safeguards and efficiencies so that we have better EMRs? I mean, you say you're not a Luddite, but what's the alternative?
Well, you know, I have to admit, my practice, we basically have opted out of the entire system. I mean, I have an electronic medical record, but it's all basically pretty much contained at our office. We don't have something that's interoperable with other systems. We're not contracted with Medicare, so I don't have to worry about all the silly rules and bureaucracy they have associated with it. But at the same time, too, the majority of physicians are employees at this point, and they're working for big hospital systems, so they really don't have a say in the matter.
Right.
And so it's really up to what the hospitals are going to do with it. And I think going forward, they really just have to put better safeguards on it, and they also have to change the rules and make them not so silly. What was a potentially very useful tool, EMR, has become a data gathering tool for the government. There's a lot of things that are mandated that physicians ask about that really don't do anything with regards to the patient's health. It's more for the government to gather data.
And what could be the downside of that? I mean, certainly the government has an interest in documenting disease trends and bringing down the cost curve of medicine. So they may say, gee, we noticed that, Dr. X is charging five times as much for the same diagnosis as Dr. Y. So maybe we ought to, you know, investigate Dr. X and get Dr. X to do more efficient medicine. I mean, I guess that would be the rationale of, you know, all these efforts to reform medicine through, you know, statistical analysis and bending the cost curve down, I think, is the term that's often used.
I think the biggest risk with government having all this data is the question of privacy. And, you know, if it's not used against you, it's not a problem. But the problem is if anybody in government, and it could be a low-level functionary for that matter, has a vendetta against you, they could use your own information against you is the risk.
But, of course, that can't happen because we know we have full faith and trust in the United States government that never use your personal information, as was so recently clearly evidenced by the IRS, right? You know, the IRS, for political purposes, I mean, they're too circumspect to do anything like that.
Point taken, absolutely. No, and you know, it is a serious concern for some people, especially, for example, I think gun ownership is not a big thing in New York, but down here in Louisiana,
yeah.
You know, if you've got a psychiatric history and somebody wants to decide you shouldn't own a gun, they could use that against you.
Yep.
They could put you in jail.
And that's that's another. It makes sense because you don't want someone who is violent, psychotic person to have access to firearms. But you know, perhaps a quarter of Americans at one time or another has had some sort of psychiatric issue. Perhaps had to take antidepressant for a while. Perhaps had an episode of reactive depression. Saw a psychiatrist. If that were to, prevent them from exercising their Second Amendment rights, what a disaster, right? And they would have a database.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing you really have to leave up to the discretion of the physician seeing the patient, because as you mentioned, I mean, the incidence of depression is, roughly about a third of the population.
Right.
You know, and it's it's and there's other potential ways you can twist the information that you've gotten in the medical mm-hmm. record to make it seem like what you want it to seem like.
Right, or, you know, the potential embarrassment. You know, say someone, has a psychiatric issue, but they're very loath to go see a psychiatrist because they're afraid it'll become part of their permanent medical record. Perhaps they're a public figure, or they just don't want it to be up there in the cloud because of the insecurity of that. Or even people who have sexually transmitted medical conditions, they may feel there's a terrible stigma attached to that, and, you know, that's going to potentially go public.
Right, and of course the secondary effect being the patient not wanting to be completely open with the physician, knowing that that information may not stay in the exam room.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you and I know instances where patients have said, look, let me share something with you off the record, and you know, we have a, you know, an informal agreement with the patient that we won't chart that because something might be subject to insurance company review, and they don't want that part of their medical record.
Certainly.
Yep. So what it seems to me is that EMRs are part of a movement in general to standardize medical practice, to almost dictate medical practice, because if I'm submitting my records to someone at an insurance company or a government reviewer, that government reviewer may say, hey, you know, Dr. Hoffman or Dr. Gianoli, you know, we don't like the way you're treating this patient. We think your treatment is too expensive or incorrect. An example with me is, since I'm an integrative physician, I work a lot with diet and nutrition. I get letters from insurance companies saying, hey, this patient is a great candidate for statin drugs. Please consider putting this patient on a statin drug. And I demur, because while that patient may have high cholesterol, in my estimation, that could be handled through diet and lifestyle. Not always. Sometimes I do prescribe statin drugs, but in many cases, the goal of the patient is to avert dependency on medication. That's the kind of thing we're seeing more of, is medicine by algorithm or by bureaucratic dictate.
Yeah, it's cookbook medicine.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, you know, one of the things that you're seeing in the hospital systems, when you have these EMRs and you have to do all your orders through the EMR, is when you want to order a particular medicine, if the patient doesn't have the appropriate diagnosis, you cannot order that medicine or that test without the appropriate diagnosis. So it does limit what you can do as a physician based on what the cookbook says.
Mm-hmm.
And the unfortunate thing is the patients don't read the cookbook. And there's a lot of them that don't fit into the cookbook, and those patients are going to suffer from it. Like you mentioned, the situation with prescription for statin drugs. I mean, it's obviously much better for a patient to improve their, you know, lipid profile with diet than it is with a statin drug. And that's the preferred way to treat it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, however, what we're going to see also is, and I think we're seeing it already, is, you know, centralized decision-making about what medical procedures are legitimate. And it sounds like you're involved in a very cutting-edge field of medicine. You it's almost like you're reinventing the book, the textbook, on certain types of delicate procedures for inner ear surgery. And Medicare or insurance companies may sit in judgment about whether your procedures are justified. And unless you get a big lobbying group of doctors who do similar procedures together to influence the decision makers in Washington, that procedure may not ever get covered. Am I reading in too much to this?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And the problem is, my field, there's only about 200 of us board certified in the country. So we are just a tiny, tiny fraction of medicine, and we're not ever going to get the attention of Medicare through our lobbying efforts. And it is an issue. In fact, I was treating this long before there was any codes for it, and so I had to make up codes for patients, you know, so that they can get some sort of reimbursement for taking care of some of their problems that just didn't exist.
And it's all about the codes. And one of the best kept secrets is that the American Medical Association represents about maybe a quarter to a third of physicians in the United States. They don't make most of their money from dues. They make most of their money by selling codes. They're the keeper of the codes. And the codes are the magic keys to reimbursement for doctors. And if you don't have a code, you're out of luck. It's cash on the barrel head for whatever it is that you want your doctor to do with you.
Yeah, you know, the other interesting thing about the codes is once you do have a code, Medicare slaps a monetary reimbursement fee on it, and if they make that reimbursement fee too low, they basically have killed that code effectively for anybody looking for that particular service. You know, it's basically price fixing.
Right.
If the price is fixed too low, nobody's going to want to do it.
Right.
Good luck trying to get that service.
Exactly. We're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you do it out of code, well, you can charge, you know, what the market will bear. But if you should be so lucky as to get it covered by Medicare, well, woe unto you, because they may give you $97.50 for doing a delicate operation.
Oh, absolutely. In my field, probably the most common procedure we do for treatment of vertigo is the Epley maneuver.
Yes.
Or cannulate repositioning maneuver, which is a relatively simple procedure, but it's got a very effective track rate in fixing a condition called benign paroxysmal positional vertigo. The problem is the reimbursement for it is around $30.
And wow.
That is so low that no doctor I know does it.
Yeah, that's terrible. Because
send them to a therapist or what have you, but they won't do it because it's so ridiculously low. They'll lose money if they do that all day.
That's terrible, because it would be really to the advantage of patients that they not receive medication that can make them feel completely schlogged out. They might get, this is a truly natural intervention to do, I'm not even sure what the maneuver is, but it's kind of a brief head adjustment, which often relieves symptoms of vertigo. And it takes a minute, it's benign. And yet, I guess because it's so low tech, Medicare doesn't see fit to reimburse it. They'd rather have you do complex surgery or something.
Yeah, it's one of these things. Again, they've set the reimbursement level so low that physicians don't want to take care of it. And unfortunately, a lot of folks that have this, they'll be dealing with something. I've seen patients that have had it for years, have been to doctor after doctor, and it's one of these things where because the reimbursement is so low, nobody's interested in dealing with it. If they did deal with it, they would go bankrupt.
Yeah.
And it's one of these unfortunate things.
It's I guess they call it perverse incentives in medicine.
Yep.
Okay, so this is a good point at which to pause, because you've given us a deep dive into an issue that a lot of people are not very familiar with. Our listeners know we divide these podcasts into two parts, and in part two, we're going to talk a little bit about more generally doctor burnout, doctors dropping out of the system, some of the factors that are making us face an unprecedented doctor shortage. Our guest is Dr. Gerard Giannoli. He's a world-famous ear, nose, and throat surgeon specializing in vestibular disorders at the Ear and Balance Institute, located in Covington. I guess that's Louisiana, right? We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about the sad direction that medicine is taking in the United States. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.